This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The two presidential candidates agree on this much. Pretty much everyone seems to agree. This election is a battle for the soul and the future of our nation. Joe Biden sees Donald Trump laying waste to our democratic institutions and our public health. Donald Trump sees the radical left looming behind Biden, just waiting to destroy America as we know it, suburbs and all. It seems that everything is at stake. And at the very same time, there's so much that can go wrong on Election Day itself.
They think they're going to send hundreds of millions of ballots all over the United States and it's going to come out. You won't know the election result for weeks, months, maybe years after. Maybe you'll never know the election result. And that's what I'm concerned with. It'll be fixed. It'll be rigged. People ought to get smart.
To get some insight into the very serious risks to our election, I called up some colleagues. Hey, Sue.
Hey, David. Can you hear me?
I can.
You can. Okay.
First up, Sue Halpern. She's a staff writer who covers election security and a scholar in residence at Middlebury College. Now, Sue, we've got a highly decentralized voting system in the United States, but I want to talk about the integrity of the vote. Are voting machines safe from interference in any way?
That's a funny question. No. I mean, most of them, yes. But a lot of them, no. So, I mean, it's a hard question. Obviously, there are, 9,000 election districts in the United States, and they all use different kinds of machinery and have different protocols. Most machines, that we've seen, have a lot of integrity. But we have states like Wisconsin, Florida, I think Michigan, that have modems in their scanners that connect to tabulators, and those are connected to the internet. And those are states that are swing states, so that's problematic. We've got machines in states that are new, and they look kind of fancy, but they are called ballot marking devices. And some of them encode your vote in a QR code or a barcode, and you have no idea whether or not the thing that the choices that you've made are actually the choices that are going into the tabulator because you can't read it. So these are just some of the issues that are arising even now as we are very conscious of the fact that machines that we use to vote on can be compromised.
So voting machines in crucial battleground states are vulnerable. And if I'm a clever fellow sitting in, St. Petersburg or Moscow, you're suggesting that things could be tampered with in a very serious way.
Sure. Things can be tampered with. The thing about hacking is that we've seen, it's possible to hack machines. We've seen this over and over and over again. But it's still a hard call to make to say that our whole electoral system is under attack in that particular way. But yeah, in swing states, they are vulnerable. And we've seen, there have been questions all along about the integrity of votes in certain places because states have used computerized machines that don't have paper trails. And if you don't have a paper trail, you can't audit. And if you can't audit, you have no idea what's gone on.
Now, have states stepped up their cybersecurity efforts? Has the federal government done that? Because as we know, in 2016, according to all our intelligence reports, Russian intelligence probed state election systems.
Right. So states have tried to increase the security of their systems. But again, remember, states don't really run the systems. They're still run by these local jurisdictions. So that, you know, that means that those jurisdictions have to have the money in order to really increase the security. So that's somewhat problematic. But, you know, DHS has gone and offered lots of cybersecurity training and that sort of thing. States have put what are called Albert sensors on their databases for voter registration. So that's helped to some extent. But we've had 4 years where the Congress has failed to enact any security legislation whatsoever.
I guess it's a very general question, but one of the deepest concern of the many millions of Americans who go to vote on November 3rd or mail in a ballot, to what degree can they be confident that their ballot will be counted properly?
That's a really, really difficult question. So what most people would say is that all of it's pretty safe. We do know that if you vote by mail, there is a chance that your vote won't be counted because you've made a mistake on, you know, you failed to put it in the right envelope or you didn't sign it correctly. And those are just things that happen, and they happen a lot. And they happen in red states and they happen in blue states, and it's not fraud. It's just, you know, human fallibility. And then when you go to your in-person and vote, chances are that's going to count. I think one thing that would be problematic and mistake is to overemphasize all of the problems that we're going to have and that we have had, which will be a disincentive for people to go to vote. I think the thing that we can really do is say, look, there are going to be problems. We know there are going to be problems. There are inherent problems with the machines, with the way we count votes, with all of these things. The best thing we can do is actually go vote. The more people who vote, in a way, the better the integrity of the system will be.
This is going to be the greatest election disaster in history. And by the way, you guys like to talk about Russia and China and other places. They'll be able to forge ballots. They'll forge them. They'll do whatever they have to do.
Steve Call is a staff writer and dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. And he's been following the saga of the U.S. Post Office. Now, Steve, not long ago, I got a letter with information on mail-in voting, and I think millions of people got this, but I understand that there have been some problems with that very letter.
The Post Office tried to write a letter, I think notionally in an effort to be helpful, that was a one-size-fits-all explanation of how to go about voting by mail. And the way they described the procedures was, for example, completely at odds with what you should do if you live in Colorado. And in fact, so at odds that the Secretary of State of Colorado concluded that it was going to actively suppress the vote by confusing people and causing people to make mistakes. So they sued to block distribution, and a federal judge ruled in favor of Colorado. I don't know how you pull things out of the mail that have already been mailed, but they did get an injunction.
Record numbers of voters plan to vote by mail this year. How large of an increase are we expected to see compared to 2016?
At least 50%, I think most of the expert forecasts say. And it's remarkable, as I was covering this, I didn't appreciate that between, say, 2004 and 2016, the number of voters who voted by mail or early in some other way more than doubled to 40% of all of the votes in the United States, even in 2016, were cast before Election Day. And this year, people are expecting that number to be close to 70%. One reason why we have so much mail voting today and why it grew even before the pandemic is that states like Florida, with heavy older populations that leaned Republican, really pioneered the idea that mail voting was good for Republicans.
And yet Donald Trump is constantly going on that mail-in voting is ripe for fraud and abuse. Does that have any grounding in fact?
No, not at the, certainly not at any scale. Yes, there are fraud cases that you can find. There was one in North Carolina fairly recently in a congressional race that had to be rerun because somebody on the Republican side had basically illegally organized some mail ballots and stuffed the ballot box, as it were. And there was occasion on the in cities like Philadelphia where, you know, old school corruption isn't completely gone, where somebody will bribe somebody to stuff a ballot box. But, I mean, these are incidental, tiny percentages of the total votes cast by mail or by all means. And so why is he doing it? I read it as a broader effort to discredit the election, to create narratives of dispute, especially if the vote is close in the Electoral College and there is litigation that follows Election Day, that he wants to put out a strong and consistent line that mail voting shouldn't be trusted. And, you know, honestly, we're in a world like you can see in parts of Central Europe and other places where the judiciary is starting to be politicized and polarized. So who's that message for? For Trump-friendly judges here and there who might just understand that this is a narrative that has an antecedent in the president's speech and that can be advanced also in adjudicating the kinds of cases that are likely to come up if the coin lands on its side in a state like Wisconsin or, you know, Ohio.
You'll have somebody like the governor of Nevada come out with this massive plan out of nowhere to take millions of ballots and send them all over the place. You'll never know who won that state. Universal mail-in ballots is going to be a great embarrassment to our country.
I'm here with Jeffrey Toobin, who covers legal affairs for The New Yorker. Now, Jeff, by one accounting, there are more than 200 pending lawsuits about the rules for the November election. What are most of these suits about?
Well, a lot of the suits have to do with the rules for absentee voting. And, for example, one of the big issues is, do the absentee ballots have to arrive at the Board of Elections by Election Day, or do they have to be postmarked by Election Day? You know, that sounds almost trivial, but when you consider the difficulties the Postal Service is having, you know, you could be talking about thousands of votes per state on that issue. That's one of the biggest issues. Other issues are, you know, will the envelopes be postage paid? How fastidious will election supervisors be about matching the signatures on the absentee ballots with the signatures in the registration forms? You know, one of the interesting things is that because of, you know, the digital economy, people just don't sign their names as often as they used to. So people's signatures change a lot over the years. And, you know, every ballot could be fought over on those grounds alone. So those are the kinds of issues that are before the courts. And there are some states like Pennsylvania where there are multiple lawsuits all heading up through the appellate process.
Isn't it possible that Donald Trump will, on election night, if he can, declare victory, and after that, some kind of havoc, real confusion will come out of it?
I mean, it will remain the case that these states will count the ballots. I mean, you know, they're and if Biden pulls ahead by a substantial number in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, in Wisconsin, then those states are going to award him the election. I think, you know, the nightmare scenario that many Democrats have is that, you know, Trump declares victory and then somehow files lawsuits or involves the Justice Department in trying to shut down the counts in these highly contested states.
Shut down the counts on what basis?
Well, that the process is so riddled with fraud that you can't trust the results. And that's one of the particularly crazy-making aspects of this whole controversy, which has been manufactured by Trump and his endless complaints about voter fraud and mail-in voting, is that it is a non-existent problem.
You recently observed one of the recounts for the Democratic Party here in the state of New York, which, of course, was slowed down by the pandemic. What was that all like? And did it give you any sense of how things might play out on a national level after Election Day?
Yeah, it was, for a essentially boring bureaucratic process, it was actually scary because I saw what was involved in election officials like ripping open envelopes, trying to read absentee ballots, comparing signatures, and you just saw how slow and difficult and tedious it was. And here we were talking about one Democratic primary in one congressional district in one state. And to think about election officials doing that kind of effort under the scrutiny, not of a fairly obscure congressional primary, but with Biden people and Trump people sitting there in front of them, on a grand scale, it was chilling to think about, you know, how ugly and long that process could be.
Between the pandemic, the attacks on the legitimacy of mail-in voting, the changes made to the post office, what is the best case constitutional scenario for resolving a contested election in 2020?
Having a landslide so you don't have to do any of this crap.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really the way to avoid this problem.
Let's say there are threats. They say that they're going to threaten riots if they lose on election night. Assuming we get a winner on election night, what are you going to do?
We'll put them down very quickly if they do that. We have the right to do that. We have the power to do that if we want. Look, it's called insurrection. We just send in and we do it very easy. I mean, it's very easy. I'd rather not do that because there's no reason for it. But if we had to, we'd do that and put it down within minutes.
Jelani Cobb is a staff writer and a professor at Columbia University who covers issues of racial justice. He recently wrote about the threat of political violence in 2020. Jelani, we have seen extraordinarily close presidential elections in this country before and even disputed elections, 1876. In 1960, it's quite possible that Illinois could have gone quite a different way in Kennedy versus Nixon, and we had Bush v. Gore in 2000. And yet this time is the first time I've really ever heard about the possibility of a true, not only a constitutional crisis, but the possibility of civil unrest following November 3rd. What are your concerns where that's concerned?
Yeah, this is one of those things that I thought about for a long time and didn't say out loud because I was wondering if I was paranoid or if there were maybe factors that would de-escalate the tensions that I wasn't taking into account. But one of the things that seems to be arguing to the contrary of that is the Transition Integrity Project report. And this is a group of people, bipartisan group of people who are former government officials, academics, journalists, policy people, who have just gamed out scenarios for the coming election. And a disturbing number of those scenarios contained some element of violence. And it's not all that shocking, given what we've seen over the summer. We've seen violence in Kenosha. We've seen widespread violence from the left and the right in the wake of George Floyd's death. We've seen in May militias marching on the state capital of Michigan with arms and then issuing so many threats to the life of Governor Gretchen Whitmer that the legislature actually had to shut down. And if we look at just what our recent history has been with Charlottesville, with El Paso, with the Tree of Life massacre that happened in Pittsburgh, it is not inconceivable that with tensions as high as they are and this kind of crescendo moment of a national election between two figures, both of whom see the opponent as an existential threat to American democracy or the American way of life, it's not hard to imagine that that will spill over into violence.
Jelani Cobb. And we heard from Jeffrey Toobin, Steve Call, and Sue Halperin, all staff writers for The New Yorker. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Some years back, The Onion, the satirical website, ran a piece about Miranda July under the headline, "Miranda July Called Before Congress," to explain exactly what her whole thing is. Miranda July's whole thing is a lot of things. She's a writer, a performance artist, a filmmaker. Me and you and everyone we know, her first big movie, remains a cult favorite. July played a performance artist trying to catch a break, a role that seemed like it might have been autobiographical.
That's a limited access floor. You need a swipe card.
Oh, I'll just get off on two then.
You want the offices?
Actually, are you Nancy Harrington?
Yes.
Okay, because I wanted to show you my art. I brought this tape I thought we could watch.
Okay, why don't you send it to this address?
Oh, but that's here. Can I just hand it to you?
It'll get lost. It's better if you send it.
But I'm so close.
Since then, July's fiction and other writing has appeared many times in The New Yorker, and now Miranda July's new film is coming out, and it's called Kajillionaire. It stars Evan Rachel Wood and Gina Rodriguez. The New Yorker's fiction editor, Deborah Treisman, recently spoke with Miranda July, who lives in L.A.
The story of Kajillionaire is it's about a dysfunctional family of sort of con artists, small-time grifters. How did this family group, these three people, parents and daughter, come to you?
I mean, they did literally come to me. Like, it was, I woke up, I was kind of wedged between my husband and child and a unhappily so, like I felt trapped. And these three characters, the two women with their long hair and this man, it was like they came walking towards me. And I remember thinking I can fall back asleep and just have this as a dream. I'm halfway there already. Or I can reach across Mike for my phone and start taking dictation, basically. And I kind of stayed in that mode for the better part of a year, just writing the first draft. Because I had other ideas for this next third movie that were good ideas, but they didn't really have the characters. But they circle some of the same themes. Like, I was definitely a mother and a daughter for the first time trying to write a movie, and there was something new there I was trying to get at.
It's interesting that the movie was inspired by thinking about motherhood, because the mother in the movie is sort of the farthest thing imaginable from a mother. She won't touch her daughter. She's never touched her daughter. They never gave her birthday presents. So I don't know. Maybe it emerges from a perspective of thinking about what motherhood should not be.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, like, as I was writing it, I didn't think, you know, this is coming from me as a mother. In fact, I was like, what is all this silly heist stuff? This just seems ridiculous. And it was only when I got to the end and read it back that I had this kind of punched in the gut feeling. And I realized, like, oh, there's some kind of icky, heartbreaking, subterranean feelings about family that I would not have willingly gone towards if it weren't for the silly heist stuff.
Okay, so we all fly to New York together on Wednesday, and then we fly right back as strangers.
So, like, one of the first images that came to me is this scene where they're at a baggage claim, baggage carousel, and for reasons to do with a heist, a scam that they're pulling, the parents and daughter have agreed that they're going to pretend to be strangers.
Then you accidentally take my bags and go home. I'll stay at the airport and report my loss. Luckily, I have traveler's insurance, so they'll issue us a check for $1,575, which we can just sign right over to Stovik the next day and be more than a full week early.
And this is a real scam. Don't ask me how I know that. just it is. And it always had struck me as such an interesting thing about it that you would pretend to be strange, that would be essential to the scam, that you'd be very close enough to these people to pull off a heist like this, but that you would pretend to be strangers, that everything would depend on that. And the idea of what if in the midst of that, your parents actually became strange. You suddenly saw them as strangers for the first time. That always has kind of worried me, that idea haunts me, of someone very familiar, of looking at their face and they've become almost like they don't know you anymore. And so when I say maternal, I don't mean in our, you know, I think it's pretty narrow, to be honest, what a woman talking about using the word maternal, like what that conjures is like one or two things. And what I'm talking about is as vast as anything else. And that potential strangeness, it was at the heart of it. And then I kind of built from there.
Yeah. There's a kind of, more than kind of heartbreaking scene later in the movie where this family that's not really a family goes to an old man's house, and he, I don't want to give too much away, but he wants them to sort of give him the soothing sounds of a real family. So this group tries to enact what a real family would do and how they would talk to each other. And it's just sort of devastating as they pretend to be, you know, so-called normal.
How was school, hon?
It was fine. But I'm starving.
Me too. Would you like some leftover cake?
And they don't really know what to say, except maybe I'll go mow the lawn, you know. Would you like a snack?
Do you think I could have some of that?
Would you like some milk?
Please.
And I suppose when I was watching it, I was going with the kind of, as you said, the silliness of the heists and the kind of slapstick comedy of haplessness. And then at some point, you feel it switch to more, it's more like a tragedy of kind of helplessness on the daughter Aldolio's part. Do you see this movie as darker than the ones you did before?
I think I was trying to walk a line. I think I thought, just as I wouldn't have willingly gone straight towards what's heartbreaking about this, I didn't think anyone else would either. And that to some degree sets the scale of the movie. I mean, it sets your budget. Like if you know there's no reality in which someone can say a new comedy by Miranda July, then you're committing to a certain path. And I knew I wanted to make a bigger movie, and that's not for the sake of it. It changes the medium. It changes your materials and what kinds of things you can think up. So, yeah, I'm not going to waste my time on something that doesn't churn for me personally. I mean, there's a reason why I write all my own stuff. I mean, I need to be at the mercy of my work, you know, for it to be worth all the trouble. And so when I was starting to look at the marketing materials for the movie and saw again and again a new comedy by Miranda July, I paused and then I was like, people like comedies. They actually go to see them. They stream them. They, you know, go with this. This is only a good thing.
Yeah. I think you can view it as a comedy and you can view it as a tragedy, and you can probably encompass both of those things at the same time, you know. I feel as though whether you're writing or making films or performing, there's sort of one constant for me in most of your work, which is that you are drawn again and again to things that are uncomfortable or awkward or embarrassing or that make people vulnerable, and that you focus in on those moments in a way that may make your audience uncomfortable too, but also forces us to sort of explore that discomfort. I'm just wondering what it is about those kinds of moments that you keeps you coming back.
Right. I never think of it that way, and then afterwards I'm having to like account for why would you do such a thing. And I'm thinking, well, I think in the moment when I'm writing it, I feel sort of an opening. You know, I think, well, I'm not sure I've seen this before, and so it feels like new space, and I get kind of excited and curious, and I think like, well, how would you show that? And then I'm writing dialogue and I'm picturing it. And so I guess to some degree, it's just like there's energy there. There's ideas to be had. There's a way to move forward. And I guess the way in which people are laid bare when they don't know what to do next, when they're sort of in just a little, not a particularly dramatic way, but they're facing the unknown.
I was thinking about your last story in the magazine, The Metal Bowl, which revolves around something from the narrator's past, which she, in order to earn money at a desperate time, she appeared in a porn movie. And she's so uncomfortable with it that she can't tell her husband about it. And yet her whole life revolves around this moment of sort of self-exposure and unanswered questions about it. And it kind of culminates in the story to this point of such awkward discomfort for everyone involved that it becomes comfortable. I don't know how better to put it. You'd have to read the story. But when you're working on a story like that, is it uncomfortable to write? Or are you just diving deep into it and experiencing it?
Well, you know, I mean, looking back, that particular story, I was uncomfortable with the idea that it seemed like this woman could be me. And I hadn't generally written like that in my fiction, and I hadn't felt set free by characters who seemed like they could be me. So, I mean, even when I submitted it, I hadn't yet really made peace with that.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me because I feel as though one of the things you are comfortable with, at least as a performer, is kind of a form of self-exposure, of vulnerability on film or on stage. So it's interesting to me that maybe you would feel more vulnerable in that way when it's on the page.
Right. So I acted in my first movie, Me and You and Everyone We Know, and the second one, The Future. And but I never did, you know, I had 10 years of writing and making work before that first feature, and I never played anyone remotely like me. And I remember even like my best friend at the time thought it was kind of funny of me, like I was sort of tricking people into thinking I was this sweet, normal girl, kind of. Like she's like, oh, you're like pretty in this movie instead of just weird. And I was like, I just had some sense that I had to be. And then that fully sort of took over. I mean, that movie kind of broke out, and that wasn't that comfortable. And I think I was actually hell bent on getting my short stories out there, because in a way those felt more like me than this avatar me that had gone ahead. Anyways, I mean, not like anyone needs to know the ins and outs of this. This is like the point in the conversation when you're talking to a friend where you're like, oh, right, never talk about writing. Like, it's just not interesting.
But I was going to say, I'm probably one person in your life who is interested in talking about writing.
Oh, right. True. Fiction editor.
But that leads me into, I read recently that you spend one night a week away from your family, away from your husband and your child, and that's a necessary thing for you. What happens in the times that you're alone? Is it a different creative space for you? Is it just mental health?
Yeah, I mean, that started initially. My friend Isabel and I would meet once a week in her studio. She's a sculptor. And I remember saying to her, what if, you know, we both have beds in our studios. There's no reason we couldn't spend the night. And that just seemed so radical, like, I mean, ridiculous, so ridiculous that that would be a radical thought. But that just shows you how locked in this, I mean, she doesn't even have a child. So, you know, it's like marriage, as if you made some agreement and as if both people, you know, really care that much. I mean, Mike didn't really care at all. Like on those nights, he and our child like eat food that I wouldn't like to eat, and they have a whole thing that they do, and
they're free,
that they're excited about. Yeah. And at that point, I didn't know there'd be a pandemic. And since March, I actually spend most of those Wednesday nights just recovering, just properly be the zombie that I couldn't be in my daytime life, being like mother, keeping things going, teaching school, doing press.
Does the new book have anything to do with isolation and being alone?
I mean, you know, as you can tell, it was conceived of before all this, and there is a way it could sort of neatly connect and take place now, but I decided not to do that. I don't understand now. I don't understand our future selves. You know, like I don't know what's going on. So I'm just, you know, doing what I always do, which is some of my feelings from now can go into this fiction.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I've talked to some fiction writers who say like it's sort of impossible now to write unless what you're writing is set pre-pandemic, and then it's sort of like historical fiction.
Right.
Or unless it's set during the pandemic, and then, you know, it's very topical, but we haven't quite digested this time.
Yeah, there's all kinds, it's sort of like, it's weird. It's like what quarantine and what a pandemic makes, it's like a different, it's a different brain. It has a different calibration. I mean, I've found that I wrote something really short for The New Yorker. But I remember thinking like, wow, I can really slam out these short pieces. And I think there is something about forms where you're making something now for people now. Mm-hmm. Now that I can do.
Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
Miranda July is the writer and director of the new movie, Kajillionaire. She spoke with Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker. You can read the story, The Metal Bowl, and a lot more work by Miranda July at newyorker.com. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Some years ago, when I was an intern at The Washington Post, I was sent off to do a feature story on a writer whom I'd always loved and still do. His name is Roger Angel. Roger is to baseball writing what Willie Mays was to baseball playing. Fleet, elegant, an everyday player who never fails to astonish you, which is why he was elected as a writer to the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. At The New Yorker, Roger Angel is nothing short of royalty. He's been publishing in the magazine since the Second World War. His mother was Catherine White, the magazine's fiction editor, and one day, Roger would take her chair, editing the likes of John Updike, Ann Beattie, and William Trevor. 20 years ago, I sat with Roger one night in the left field seats of Shea Stadium, eating popcorn, drinking beer, and biting my nails. It was a glorious night. Yankees-Mets, a Subway Series. It was Game 5, and as it turned out, the clincher for the Yankees. And in the locker room afterward, awash in champagne, the Yankee manager Joe Torre greeted Roger as a visiting eminence, a peer. We left the locker room soaked in Dom Perignon. Now I'd like us to lift a glass to celebrate Roger Angel one more time. Pretend you've got some bubbly at home because he's turning 100. Roger joined me on the Radio Hour a few years ago, and he was just 95 at the time, and a collection of his work called This Old Man, All in Pieces, had just been published. Roger, you practiced nonfiction, as it were, by night, and fiction by day. For years and years, you were the fiction editor of The New Yorker. To this day, you read short stories for us and in the fiction department. Was this bread in the bone with you? I think some of our listeners will know that your mother really had singular responsibility for introducing serious fiction to The New Yorker, Catherine White. And you must have grown up hearing about this process and knowing this process.
My stepfather was E.B. White, who was E.B. White and writing for the magazine every week. And my mother and stepfather's house was full of galleys and pencils and eraser rubbings and conversation about the magazine and about Harold Ross and about the writers of the day. And sure, I paid close attention, but I wasn't planning to be a New Yorker editor or to be a New Yorker writer.
What were you planning on?
I was hoping to be maybe a boy naturalist, a herpetologist with my first day. But I did pay attention.
Now tell me about This Old Man by Roger Angel, All in Pieces.
Roger Angel, All in Pieces. Well, I'm a little tired of the joke and the title already.
But tell me about the book itself. You've got in here some obituaries that were published in The New Yorker or online. You've got a couple of long, sustained essays, some baseball writing.
Well, I wrote the piece, This Old Man. I started the piece in 2013, I think, late in the year, and I think handed it to you along about February, something like that.
It came as a complete surprise to me. Plopped it on my desk, done.
I wrote it in different pieces. I didn't quite know what I was doing, and it was about physical debility, and it starts off with a description of my arthritic hands, and
which you say the tips of your fingers look like they've been the subject of torture by the KGB.
Yeah, if I point my forefinger at you like a pistol and fire it up for your nose, I hit you in the knee. But I describe some of the everyday debilities of age, and I didn't quite know what I was doing, but I knew that loss was at the middle of this. I had lost my wife of 48 years. I'd lost a daughter and a beloved dog of Carol's and mine. Went out the fifth floor window in the middle of a panic, jumped out the window on the fifth floor and was killed. Losses for people my age are common. Ed Hirsch, the wonderful poet, lost his son and wrote a great book about it last year. And he says that anybody over the age of 65 has a 100-pound bag of cement of loss on his shoulders. So I didn't know how to touch on these subjects, and I didn't know if I wanted to even. And I did so actually through the loss of the dog. And I described the death of Harry, this dog, and then threw in that Carol and I wept. We couldn't get over weeping for him. And he lay in our bathroom between us on the floor, and we threw Kleenex back and forth. And I said we were also weeping for my daughter, Callie, who had committed suicide a couple of years earlier, and events that we knew we couldn't just get our minds around in any way, but it was for both. But I don't want to dwell on this. I didn't want to make much of this because everybody's experienced loss. And there are many changes of mood through this piece. I patched the thing together, and some of the sadder paragraphs that are hard to take are often followed by a joke or a lighter moment. And there's some actual jokes in there, and it's okay because I like to take jokes. I count on jokes myself. I'm known to tell jokes.
And there's also the opposite of loss. There's new love.
Yes, and this was happening. I was finding someone new in my life, my present wife, Peggy, and time was going by, and I was still engaged in life, and I said that old people are like everyone else. We need connection. We need love. We need intimate love.
I mean, there's sex. The piece ends with life against all other things.
Against all odds, yes. But I wanted to say what was happening with me, which happens with other old people. Old people fall in love. Old people have love life, have intimate connections, have sex lives. And people don't like to admit this, mostly their children, but
because they're somehow revolted by it.
But I think people are getting over this because it's now known. I mean, it's not something to be repelled by. It's something to be grateful for. This brings up something else, which I've noticed with writers that I've dealt with. Now and then, if a writer lives long enough, this didn't just happen much with American writers. The famous thing about American writers was there are no second acts in American lives. Writers that go on and on often go back, as Updike did, go back to the same subjects again and again. He went back to his mother, to the sandstone farmhouse, to his father, to his teenage courting years, and did the same story really again and again, but much better each time with increased feeling. Some of the very best stories he wrote for us were at the very end. And the same thing happened with another writer of mine that I edited over a period of 40 years, V.S. Pritchett, the great British writer. In his middle 80s, suddenly he got on this amazing hot streak writing some of the greatest stories of his life, full of sex, full of amour, and adventures and comedy and childhood things all rushing out of him. And I think that all of us do this at any age because we basically go over the same material in our minds again and again, the stories that really mean a lot to us. And psychologists and experts on the subject say that this is what memory is. It is a trying out of a scenario again and again, because it may be of use. That's what memory is. And this is why the same scenes recur. After I wrote scenes, a lot of this personal stuff, I used to have dreams about or think about over. And once I put them down and get them published, I don't think about them anymore. It's very strange. It goes away.
When you go back and read your earlier stuff, do you recognize it? Does it feel like you?
Not the very early stuff. No, it feels like Hemingway.
And can you relate it all to a decision like Philip Roth's to stop writing?
Well, I haven't got there yet. I'm extremely lucky. I'm 95 and still writing, my goodness.
Roger Angel from our interview in 2015. He's turning 100.
Hello?
Hey, Roger, it's David.
David, how are you?
I'm great. How you doing? I'm calling to wish you a happy birthday.
Thank you.
I'm okay.
I had a tooth pull this morning, but I'm over it.
You had a tooth pulled?
Oh, yeah. My God.
Happy birthday there.
Thank you.
God. How are you feeling about this birthday?
Well, it seems that so since we had this big celebration in Maine months in advance, it just goes on forever. But there's another thing that's come up, which is my birthday is on Rosh Hashanah. And
Believe me, I know.
Friends of mine, Jewish friends of mine, good friends, we celebrate this every year with our Jewish friends. But some of them called the other day and said that they were thinking of me that on the birthday. And for this year, they're going to call Rosh Hashanah.
Rosh Hashanah. Fair enough. Look, the greatest hero of my childhood was Sandy Koufax. And the great thing about him is that he wouldn't pitch on Yom Kippur.
I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that. And then everybody saying that I knew was saying, what is Yom Kippur?
The day of forgiveness and repentance. So have you been looking forward to this birthday or dreading it?
Well, sure, I've been looking forward to it, but as I say, it keeps going on, and I'm going to do a bunch of different Zooms and meetings and gatherings, and it's been very sweet. I've had wonderful messages from people, from old friends and colleagues and people I barely know, and from strangers as well. So I'm very touched. It's really very extraordinary to me.
Well, we're gathering the staff on Friday afternoon, and we're going to all Zoom toast you. I wish it were at my place in a big party with lots of champagne, but as they terribly say all the time now, it is what it is.
I know. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Roger, I just have to tell you, I'm sending love from everybody at WNYC, everybody from The New Yorker. We love you. What can I
Good.
Say?
Thank you.
Happy Rosh Hashanah. Chag Sameach.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care, my friend.
Bye.
I'm David Remnick, and that's our show for today. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.